You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 30th of June, 2022, on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS.
Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up.
It's been the most significant abuse of power since World War II and an invasion of that many people into another country in Europe. Some people thought that was not likely to happen again, but it did. But we responded. We responded in unison.
The NATO summit continues in earnest, Ukraine dominating the agenda. But can the world's most fearsome military alliance come up with a long-term strategy to turn the tide of the war? Also ahead, one of President Trump's aides claims he raged at security guards and grabbed the steering wheel of his presidential car on the day his supporters stormed the US Capitol. We'll examine the significance of her testimony. Plus, we find out why press freedom is under threat in the Philippines. The Austrian author and journalist Tessa Shishkovitz reviews today's papers, and we explore a groundbreaking new exhibition at London's Haywood Gallery. That's all ahead on The Globalist. Before we begin, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The only surviving member of the group that carried out attacks in Paris in November 2015 has been found guilty of terrorism and murder charges. US intelligence agencies have claimed that the Russian President Vladimir Putin still wants to capture most of Ukraine. And Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has been sworn in as the new president of the Philippines in a ceremony in Manila. And the Monocle Minute reports on the much-awaited return of international travel between Tokyo's Haneda and Seoul's Gimpo airports. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, what exactly does the NATO alliance view as victory in Ukraine? The leaders of 30 member states have spent the last 24 hours at their summit in Madrid issuing steely statements of unity against Moscow. Russia is the most significant and direct threat to ally security and to peace and stability in the Euro-Atlantic area, they say. NATO will continue to further step up political and practical support to Ukraine, they add. But what does NATO want? Well, Paul Rogers is an international security advisor at Open Democracy, and he joins me now. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Hello.
Very good to have you back on the programme. So let's begin with this question. What is victory for NATO?
That really is the absolutely spot-on question, because we simply don't know. There's a range of views within the West. You have people who many would describe as hawks in the United States and to some extent in Europe, who basically see complete victory and not just the humiliation of Russia, but basically crippling it economically and militarily for as long as possible, maybe for a generation. This really is seen as the opportunity to sideline one potential nuclear superpower, even though it's not an economic superpower. Other people are a lot more sanguine and basically say that is a dangerous path, because fundamentally, if Putin is really pushed to the corner, he always has the option to escalate to chemical and maybe nuclear weapons. The wider view, I think, which is less to the fore for obvious political reasons, is that at some stage there have to be negotiations. And that means that Russia will gain something small out of this appalling mess and the war that it started. And it goes right back to what it was looking at originally, and that was maintaining control of Crimea and essentially taking control of a couple of oblasts in the Donbass region. So you get that range of views. Obviously, you're not going to say that in public, but in private, many people within NATO, I think particularly in countries like Germany and to some extent France, take this view.
So tell us a little bit more then, when you hear that the US military intelligence reports that Vladimir Putin intends to take all of Ukraine, what does NATO do in response to that? I mean, they are able to talk about it around the table in Madrid today.
Well, there's all the difference in the world between Vladimir Putin wanting to take Ukraine and having the ability to take Ukraine. And it's blindingly obvious that he does not have that. I mean, now the Russian war aim has been reduced from basically regime change and direct control of large parts of Ukraine through to control of the fairly narrow area, which included the two separatist areas. And you have a, you know, what was assumed to be a conventional military superpower unable to do that. And it certainly is not going to be able to get back beyond that in any sense because of the way in which Ukraine can and is being armed by the West. We now know that these new, very advanced HIMARS systems, the multiple rocket launchers, which are superior in range and accuracy to the Russian ones, are now at the front line and are starting to be used and having an effect. There aren't enough of them, but there's no doubt at all that the United States will be pushing a lot more in. The blunt truth is that NATO will not allow Ukraine to lose this war. Putin will not allow Russia to lose this war because it has the nuclear option. And this is why you have to accept that there has to be another way out. It's very difficult, but this is the reality of what has happened and why this goes right. Well, we know it goes back 20, 30 years to what was the making of this war.
And it is also, for all the wrong reasons, arguably the remaking of NATO. It's not long since Emmanuel Macron described the organisation as brain dead. Donald Trump found it irrelevant at the start of his tenure. But now it is being announced. Joe Biden is saying that this is now NATO's moment.
Yes, and it's very clear that NATO is very much on the up. It is united against what Putin wanted. It's failed completely in that. And you're seeing the possibility of the best part of 300,000 troops earmarked for forward deployment. Most of them will not be moved to the neighbourhood of Russia, but they will be available. And we even have a British aircraft carrier capability, which is going to be earmarked for that. That is a very long way from the idea of using these for sort of global military force projection. So yes, things have changed a great deal. The extraordinary thing is, you're right, you did have these criticisms, perhaps less seriously from Trump, because you can never predict him, but from Macron it was serious. And that's basically because NATO had had been in so much trouble over Afghanistan. You know, had 20 years of a war with NATO heavily involved. And NATO is part of the process in which that failed. So, yes, there had to be a real rethink of NATO. It is happening, but it's happening in terms of increasing the levels of armed forces. So one of the overall results of this, possibly the most dangerous one, is we're seeing a new arms race between Russia and the West. And we simply do not know where that's going to go, or indeed how China will perform on this and how China will behave. There are many unknown questions which are very difficult to answer at present. But the bottom line is NATO obviously is a lot stronger out of this. Russia is a lot weaker, but that does not mean that the war is anywhere near an end.
But how strong is NATO, given the fact that in a little while we hope to be hearing from Alyona Khlypko, who's incredibly good at talking about what Ukraine needs? Yes. And there is that fear, isn't there, that what NATO wants to do and the way that it considers this conflict as a long-term issue is not what Ukraine wants, for very understandable reasons. Volodymyr Zelensky and the residents of Ukraine want this thing done quickly, and they're calling on NATO to step it up.
They do certainly want it. It's absolutely understandable. I mean, you look what happened to that shopping center just a couple of days ago. From the Ukrainian point of view, it has to end quickly. But the point is, that means all-out war with Russia, from NATO to Russia. It's the only way it can end very quickly. That's the situation we're in. It's absolutely understandable that from a Ukraine perspective, you always give the worst-case scenario. You have to do that because NATO really is not prepared to do enough unless it really almost... Ukraine insists that it does enough. But there is a problem here because many people in NATO are frankly afraid of escalation. And this is always a situation where you have a crisis involving two nuclear powers or a nuclear power and a nuclear alliance, that something goes wrong, which is unintended. And that, I think, is one of the other factors which the planners will be really very conscious with in both Washington and, I think, particularly in Brussels with the NATO headquarters just outside.
And in terms of the long-term strategic plans for NATO, are we right in thinking that it's actually becoming a more European organisation? It is majority European. 28 of the 30 member states are from Europe. But is this now becoming an essentially European organisation?
It is, and that itself has a new danger in a way, because it is clear that although the United States is very strong on this, it's supporting Ukraine, in the longer term, what the United States wants is for Europe to be much stronger on its defences and for the United States to concentrate on the Indo-Pacific. It's very clear that China in the long term is seen as a greater problem for the United States than Russia. And that is likely to set up new tensions in NATO when apparently, you know, everything was going well. But that would only follow some end to this terrible war, which has to be in some stages a negotiation, with the greatest concessions being obviously, well, not concessions, the best result coming for Ukraine, but with some concessions to Russia. I don't see any easy way out of that, short of risking a massive escalation to the use of weapons of mass destruction.
Tell us a little bit more about the way that NATO will reform itself, or not reform, but it's expansion now that we have the successful application of Sweden and Finland to join NATO. It created huge tensions with Turkey, didn't it? And some people are saying, what is it that Turkey managed to secure in order for it to agree to Sweden and Finland's arrival? Do we know what that was?
We don't know for sure, but I think apart from issues on the nature of arms sales and what arms sales are allowed, it seems to have secured support for Turkey's attitude to the Kurdish forces within Turkey. But more significantly, it's going to withdraw. This is basically Sweden and Finland are likely to withdraw their support for the Kurdish groups in northeast Syria, which are very much disliked by Turkey. They're seen as part of the wider Kurdish community. Many people see it very differently. Many people remind us that, in fact, those Kurdish groups, the Peshmerga and others in northeast Syria, were very important in basically crippling ISIS. So that, I think, is a tension which is within that. It'll probably come to the fore sometime. But in the short term, because of the need to get Finland and Sweden into NATO, basically this concession has been made to Turkey, which apparently has proved sufficient.
Paul Rogers from Open Democracy, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, as we've just been hearing, NATO has been debating its strategy for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but the conflict has been continuing unabated while all the talking has been going on in Madrid. And what NATO says it can do, Ukraine may not want or need. Ukraine wants the war over for good reason. Is the rest of the world matching the pace? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Iona Klivko, who's a political consultant, former Ukrainian local MP, and a regular voice here in the studio at Monocle 24. Welcome back, Iona.
Thank you.
We just heard there from Paul Rogers about the fact that NATO moves slowly. It has a long strategy. It is bringing itself together slowly. And it is committing to help Ukraine. But there is that fear that it's just not doing it as quickly as Ukraine wants it to happen.
I think, unfortunately, we've seen that tendency of the world being always kind of one step behind. Whether with sanctions from the very beginning of the war or with military aid. Even now, we're seeing this turnaround in the war and Russia advancing in the east because the weapons that we're receiving now and expecting in July should have been there in May. Then we would have seen a completely different situation. But of course, we're being realistic here, and it's understandable that NATO is not just one body. It's a union of 32 independent sovereign states with their own interests and opinions and neighbors. And various economic and political ties. So it's a massive chunk of work to uniform any sort of decisions and get everyone on board. So, of course, the process is not easy, but at least it's going in the right direction.
One thing that we mentioned a little bit earlier was the issue of what victory looks like. I mean, NATO cannot decide what it will be happy with in terms of the end of this conflict. What is it that Ukraine wants? The entire expulsion of any Russian presence in going right back to pre-2014 borders? Or what is it that Ukraine would want that it thinks that NATO could help it achieve?
Well, it's very reassuring to hear NATO Secretary General saying that Ukraine will be at the discussion table and it's whatever Ukraine will be happy with that will be the outcome of this war. But I think it's important for the world to understand that whatever Ukraine wants will be the best outcome for the world, because regaining our sovereignty and getting all of our territories back will only show to the world that we're still living in the international rules-based order, as we did shortly after the Second World War. That order has not been jeopardized in any way. Rules still apply, and all the potentially aggressive states need to follow those rules. Now, when we're talking about Ukraine, I think Ukraine's government has said many times that we need to begin with returning to the situation pre-February 24th for Russia to retreat from everywhere in the east and in the south, liberate Kherson and all the occupied territories of Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia and Kherson region. And then we can start negotiating about returning the rest of the territories, including Donbass and Crimea.
How much in that context has the Russian capture of Severodonetsk changed the war?
I don't think it's changed that much. Obviously, if Russia tries to encapsulate the whole of Donetsk and Luhansk region into Russian Federation, which is their initial goal, they want to capture it, the two regions up to the admin borders, start giving away Russian passports, and eventually, I think their initial goal to get it done by the 11th of September, which is the unified election day in Russian Federation. So they will want to hold some sort of referendums or elections or any staged performance of that kind to kind of assimilate the two regions into Russian Federation. So that will be a crucial turnaround. Right now, the situation in the east is very dynamic. So Ukrainian troops retreated from Severodonetsk, but they're still fighting for Lysychansk and Bakhmut. So the situation can change any day, really.
And we're talking now about the fact that Vladimir Putin wants to take the whole of Ukraine, which is this is what US military intelligence is saying, but he does not have the resources to do so. And is that what is being felt among the fighting in Ukraine, that there is a sense that the Ukrainians can withhold and withstand this because Russia is wearing itself out?
I think what the world was surprised about is that Ukraine can withhold Russia in general, even with their full supply of weapons and mobilization that they've tried to take Kyiv with. They have failed. Right now, of course, their supply chain has been drastically affected by the sanctions. They no longer receive semiconductors from Taiwan or microchips from the West. They can't resupply their missiles, but they still have quite a lot. I think the number that Zelensky mentioned even yesterday is over 2,000 missiles and rockets were fired at Ukraine since the beginning of this active phase of war. And according to some military intelligence from Ukrainian military, Russia initially had 5,000 that we were aware of. So there's still plenty of supply there. They might go for covert mobilization, which they started. They might go for more contract fighters. So we shouldn't discount the fact that Russia is a very big state and they could find resources if they need them. But eventually, I think inevitably, they will start running out of those resources.
And how much support is there still? I mean, we are seeing Volodymyr Zelensky popping up from everywhere, from the UN to Glastonbury,
right,
with this well-recognisable way of just talking to the rest of the world, making that emotional connection, being a brilliant world leader. What are the thoughts in Ukraine now?
Ukrainians are getting really tired of the war. And I discussed this yesterday, actually, with LSE postgraduate students who are doing communications course. And they were saying, well, is there still a support in Ukraine for President Zelensky? And I think it's not so much about individually him or the government. It's the general awareness of the war. People were very mobilized in the beginning. They've put in all the resources. People skipped jobs to go volunteer. They gave away the last pennies they had from their salaries to support military. If you saw within the last couple of weeks, people crowdfunded money for 4 drones to buy from Turkey, over $100 million. And then Turkey ended up gifting those, which was very kind of them. But people are still trying to do their best for the war. But when they're seeing that So many Ukrainian young guys are dying, and, you know, the funerals are happening all over Ukraine regularly. Missiles are still flying into civilian objects. There is that prevailing feeling of running on last fumes. And I know we can't afford that, because relaxing and giving up is not the luxury that we have at the moment. We need to brace ourselves for at least another couple of months of war. Some experts are saying October, November, who knows? So I think generally that affects the mood in Ukraine.
Ayana Hlivko, thank you so much as ever for joining me in the studio. Still to come on today's programme, an update on the Capitol Hill hearings. We find out why press freedom in the Philippines is under threat. And the Austrian journalist and author Tessa Shishkovitz will be here to review the papers with me. Stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's get an update now on the hearings into the riots on Capitol Hill in January last year. This week has seen perhaps the most explosive account of life inside the White House from a young assistant called Cassidy Hutchinson, who witnessed Donald Trump's violent and volatile mood swings firsthand. Well, Scott Lucas is an associate at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin, also a regular observer of all things to do with the US. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you, Emma. Great to be here.
So what can you tell us about this testimony? It was fairly extraordinary. It was one of those moments when you just think, is the name Cassidy Hutchinson going to be that surprise figure that stays with us in history?
Yeah, it's like one of those moments back in the Watergate hearings for someone who's old enough to remember that, when John Dean, who was then a little-known White House assistant, came up and talked about Nixon's taping system, which led to his downfall. Now, what Cassidy Hutchinson did, she was the chief aide to the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, was in some ways even more extraordinary, because she wasn't just talking about a taping system. She was talking about, in the days leading up to the Capitol attack and on the day itself, watching and observing the central figures who effectively had planned this. This wasn't a thought bubble by Donald Trump. This was premeditated. And it got to the point where Hutchinson was describing Donald Trump having given his speech outside the White House, telling his supporters, go to the Capitol, stop the steal, stop Joe Biden from becoming president, where Trump gets into his limousine called the Beast, thinks he's going to be taken to the Capitol. The Secret Service agent says, no, you're not, sir. We're taking you back to the West Wing. This is not a secure situation. And Trump assaults the Secret Service agent, tries to grab him by the collarbone, and tries to seize the wheel. You know, that was one vivid moment. What was even more striking about Hutchinson is that moment came only after days of extraordinary moments where not only Trump, but his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, well, as Giuliani put it, Cass, are you excited? Are you ready? President Trump is going to the Capitol. He's going to show how powerful he is.
It is perhaps not surprising that we heard accounts of Donald Trump having a volatile nature inside the White House. But how much does this actually feed in to the hearings themselves? And what will be the effect of Hutchinson's testimony?
Yeah, again, I don't think you wind up serving a prison term for volatility or even have your political career destroyed. What happens is, however, is if you're not just volatile, but if you have planned for months for that moment when your supporters have been encouraged to attack the Capitol, and when they go in and threaten the execution of your vice president, Mike Pence, and legislators, if you've been planning that, that's a different matter. And that's what the rest of the hearings have really pointed out. You know, we had moved from the initial phase, you know, after on election night when Trump said, oh, I've won. We've moved from those failed legal challenges by December to him putting pressure on the state on the states to throw out Biden's electors and put in Trump's illegal, where he put pressure on the Justice Department to overturn the election, and his attorney general, one of his biggest defenders, William Barr, telling him this was all BS. There was no electoral fraud. We'd moved to him and this inner circle of lawyers and aides working with groups, including right-wing militia, to organize those rallies on January the 6th. In other words, if you're not just volatile, but if you're planning what amounted to a coup, yeah, that's a far more serious thing.
But what will the consequences for Donald Trump be from this testimony, given the fact that politically, if he has a solid base who will be in, you know, absolutely resisting any kind of allegations, then he's anything other than fantastic. And then there will be perhaps criminal charges for him or not?
Well, starting on the criminal front, that's a wait and see, because the House committee cannot charge Donald Trump with anything. It's not a criminal court. It can recommend that the Justice Department pursue an investigation of Trump on the basis of what they found. But right now, the committee is split on whether to make that formal recommendation. And the Justice Department, I think, is going to be hesitant about the publicity if it opens up that investigation, which could take, you know, obviously weeks and even months. Politically, I think that's a different matter. I think you're going to see two things here. I think the first is the revelations are going to make Trump even more toxic to the mainstream of the Republican Party. Do you really want this guy leading you in 2024 when he's got the stain of an attempted coup on his hands? And I think you're going to see maneuvers behind the scenes, including by Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in Congress, to try to limit Trump, to try to box him in. But that raises the question, can Trumpists be boxed in? There are a lot of supporters of Donald Trump who are going to try to get office in Congress this November. There are a lot who are already there. And there are some politicians who will use Trumpist techniques, possibly not pursuing a coup, but using his rhetoric, using his divisiveness. And I think one of the big winners out of the hearings right now is a guy in Florida named Governor Ron DeSantis, who really, really wants to be the Republican nominee for president in 2024.
How will he take advantage of this?
Oh, he will present himself as the rising face of what is effectively the Trumpist Republicans, that he's the man who will carry the mantle of defending, quote, them against their supposed enemies, the extremists, the radicals, the Democrats, journalists like you, academics like me, and he will do so without having the baggage of the Capitol attack on his hands.
Just tell us a little bit more about where this leaves the United States, because we've heard this damning account of what was going on in the White House. We have to remember that the Capitol Hill riots were, in many ways, that moment when we worked out just how deeply divided the United States was, that people did no longer believed in American democracy. And last week we had the Roe versus Wade judgment being overturned, which led to people saying that they no longer had faith in the Supreme Court because it had become far too politicized. Where does this leave America? Because the discussion in the last 7 days has been a suggestion that it is in a parlous state in terms of the institutions that hold it together.
We're in the biggest crisis for American democracy since the U.S. Civil War, and it's been going on for years. We went through the episode of a man getting office, getting the White House, in part because his people collaborated with a foreign power to get him elected. We have a man who was impeached the first time because he tried to blackmail another country, Ukraine, into dishing dirt on his political opponent, Joe Biden. We are now had a man who was impeached a second time because he incited violence over the Capitol. And he's still there. But I think more importantly, he and others have wreaked damage on institutions like the Supreme Court, which rips at the social fabric of the United States. And there the crisis takes on a new hue, because it wasn't Donald Trump who packed the Supreme Court with those conservatives or who pursued it initially. It was the establishment Republicans like Mitch McConnell who effectively politicized the court, with women as the casualties in Roe versus Wade, possibly with LGBT folks being the victims if further rights are curbed. So no, even if Donald Trump is kept in his social media box and is not on Twitter, the threat remains from those like Ron DeSantis, who will use his techniques, and those, quote, more mainstream Republicans who have tilted institutions to breaking point. But Emma, the system still stands. After all that battering, good Americans have made sure the system still stands. And the hearings are one example of how the system continues even in the face of those who wanted to destroy it.
Resilient words. Thank you so much, Scott Lucas. The time is 7:31 here in London. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Let's have a quick look at the headlines. The only surviving member of the group that carried out attacks in Paris in November 2015 has been found guilty of terrorism and murder charges. Salah Abdeslam received a rare full life sentence for his role in the gun and bomb attacks that killed 130 people. 19 others were also convicted. US intelligence agencies have claimed that the Russian President Vladimir Putin still wants to capture most of Ukraine. The officials added, however, that his invading forces have been significantly weakened by months of combat, and they're only capable of making slow territorial gains. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has been sworn in as the new president of the Philippines in a ceremony in Manila. The 64-year-old is a member of an infamous political family which was ousted in a popular revolt in the 1980s. His landslide victory means he replaces Rodrigo Duterte as the country's leader. And the Monocle Minute reports on the much-awaited return of international travel between Tokyo's Haneda and Seoul's Gimpo airports. The route was an incredibly popular one before being shut down in the pandemic. You can find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, as we've just been hearing in the news headlines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has just been sworn in as the new president of the Philippines in a ceremony in Manila. But there are concerns that his rule will not get the scrutiny that it warrants, with a Rappler news agency being told to cease operations ahead of his inauguration. Maria Ressa is a Nobel Prize winner who runs a company. She has promised to keep the site running. But in what circumstances will she be able to? Richard Haydarian is an academic columnist and author of The Rise of Duterte, a populist revolt against elite democracy, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Good morning, or good afternoon, Richard.
Good morning and good afternoon. It's always a pleasure.
It's good to have you with us. Now, just explain to us, can you just tell us what's happened today?
Well, today the unexpected and expected happened at the same time. I mean, I know internationally people are scratching their head and wondering, oh my goodness, they let another Marcos take over the presidential palace in the Philippines, considering the history of the Marcoses, how they were toppled by people power over three decades ago. But at the same time, if you look at it, there's nothing really surprising about it. Since their return from exile, luxurious exile in Hawaii, they were back in 1991, just a few years after being overthrown. They have tried to come back to power. They have been knocking at the doors of the Malacañang presidential palace year after year after year. As early as 1992, former First Lady Imelda Marcos, who, by the way, today was also there during the inauguration, witnessing a second Marcos in office, she was running for president in 1992. And the Marcoses have been winning different positions of government, Senate, governor, almost vice presidency. So perhaps it was just a matter of time before the Marcoses broke through. And this is exactly what happened today. And in many ways, this is the legacy of President Duterte. Duterte, over the past 6 years, really undermined the foundations of liberal democracy. He really rehabilitated the Marcoses, reburied the remains of former dictator in the Cemetery of National Heroes. And here, his daughter is also coming in as the vice president of the Philippines. And she was one of the major factors why Marcos was able to become the president with a huge mandate of almost 60% of the votes. The first majority-based president since his father, Marcos Jr.
So we have a double dynasty in charge here in the Philippines. And as a result, how surprised are you that the Rappler news agency found itself being closed down just at the crucial time when Duterte is leaving? So there is ample opportunity to investigate his past acts, and there's ample opportunity to keep a very close eye on the Marcoses.
Right. I mean, the thing is, the state of the Philippine media is really perilous. I mean, on one hand, of course, Rappler is not the only independent agency in the country, but it has been one of the most outspoken, internationally recognized one. You know, on the other hand, I mean, we also have to look at what Marcos wants to do. I mean, the Marcos has said that they want to kind of redeem themselves. They don't want to waste a second chance. At the same time, they are very confident because they have a huge mandate. They have the support of the Duterte's For now, it looks like Marcos really focuses on economic recovery, really economics, you know, with the food crisis, and he has even appointed himself as the Department of Agriculture secretary. But I think the storm will come eventually, and the storm is historical revisionism, perhaps push to revise the Philippines historical textbooks. And also, what will Marcos do with the worst aspects of Duterte's presidency, the drug war, for instance? Will he continue the drug wars? Will there be as many extrajudicial killings? I'm slightly optimistic on that front. We may see some good changes actually under President Marcos. But on the media front, will he restore the franchise of ABS-CBN, the largest media network in the country? Will he intervene against Rappler or in favor of Rappler, because Rappler is now also contesting their case? Will he free, for instance, former Senator Leyla de Lima, who was imprisoned by Duterte on politically charged, on questionable politically charged, allegations? So let's see what will be that, what will be the case. I think much will also depend on international pressure, because I think the Marcoses want to impress the world, want to say that they're different. So yeah, I think if there is enough and sufficient effective international pressure on them, Marcos may actually prove us wrong. He may turn out better than many of his critics think. On the other hand, you know, you don't want to be overly optimistic. I think it's very likely that the Philippines in the coming years will end up a hybrid regime, something like Hungary there in Europe, you know, a country that has semi-competitive elections, but freedom of media, freedom of civil society, freedom of opposition, they're very much liminal, protean and under siege.
Richard Hedarian, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist, where the time here in London is just nudging 7:38. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Tessa Shishkovitz, Austrian journalist and author. Lovely to see you, Tessa. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning.
What's caught your eye?
Well, after the NATO summit, of course, there's a lot of spin-offs on the economic war also that Russia is unleashing against the Ukraine over its grain. And the FT has a good story here about the ongoing negotiations where Turkey is trying to broker an end to the grain export from Black Sea ports. But of course, that's not very likely to happen anytime soon.
No, because we have now Turkey having formally sort of allied itself within NATO now, so sort of chosen its path, perhaps, by agreeing to allow Sweden and Finland to join NATO.
Yes.
Turkey is now having to broker this naval blockade that the Russians have established in the Black Sea. And this naval blockade is effectively stopping the world from being fed, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's not the whole world, but there will be possibly famines in the Middle East, which is highly dependent on Ukrainian grain, wheat, in the next month, in the next winter. So we have to do something. And of course, there are attempts to get Russia to let wheat being exported, but it's quite tricky because you have to demine possibly the Ukrainian ports and the water, so to even get the ships out. So there's lots of small tricky bits, but the big question is if Russia has an interest in doing that, because Russia, of course, profits highly from crippling the Ukrainian economy and not only Ukrainian territory.
It does, and it is one of the things that the fight may be continuing in Ukraine, but Russia knows full well that blockading the access of grain from the rest of the world, just as the harvest is, you know, it's not quite there yet. We've got a month or two before they have to start harvesting Ukrainian wheat. It knows full well that it could absolutely hold the world to ransom on this, couldn't it?
Not completely, because the storage is full now in the Ukraine. So the new harvest should take this space, and it should be exported. There's a second story in the FT which is also interesting about Russia using the Crimean ports to export grain, which from Russia, which is not under sanctions, but the ports in Crimea are under sanctions. So the question is if that's legal. So there's lots of this like economic warfare going on.
Let's move to an amazing story in Netzpolitik, which I need to read a bit more of if the stories are like this. This is a comment on the fact that when you are a world leader or a leader of an enormous body such as the European Union, you should let everybody read your text messages. Now, people are welcome to read mine. They're as boring as they come. They're sort of like, can you take the chicken out of the freezer? And I'm going to be late. But Ursula von der Leyen's text messages, I can imagine, are pretty good. And we're being implored to get her to share them with us. What tell us all about how this has come about.
So if you remember, during the pandemic at the beginning, Ursula von der Leyen for the EU Commission was negotiating with the boss of Pfizer about how much the EU's countries would pay for the vaccine. And all this went, or not all of it, but some of it went over phone calls and text messages. And thanks to the New York Times and FT and other media, we know what she offered and what she didn't offer, but she didn't make her chats, her text messages public, because she says that these are sort of not documents. They are sort of short-living messages, and they are not counted as documents. The documents have to be always made transparent according to the Charter of Basic Rights of the European Union in Article 42. It's quite clear that it doesn't matter what form documents have, they should be transparent. So there's a big question about transparency rights in the EU, and Ursula von der Leyen will have to deal with that. And this website, Netzpolitik, has actually done quite serious work in asking for more transparency. And there's this commentary that Alexander Fanta, who works for Netzpolitik, wrote in Politico this morning, where he explains this case quite well. I can only recommend looking into it, because this will be always and ever more, you know, all these WhatsApp groups that we are seeing mushrooming everywhere in parliaments and in institutions.
There is a balance to be struck, though, isn't there? Because I think there's been an enormous scrutiny here in the United Kingdom, at least, where a lot of government business has been done on WhatsApp, which is against government policy. I mean, PPE was procured through WhatsApp, and it was thought as a side that the government was doing things that couldn't be trusted, that they couldn't go through the official channels because they decided to use WhatsApp instead. And it makes you it offers the wider question, doesn't it? What is now an official channel? Is a WhatsApp group an official channel, or is it a WhatsApp group?
Well, I think, and also WhatsApp will be superseded by other means of communication very soon. So we just need to bring up the legislation and say, like, if you do government policy on whatever channel, it needs to be made transparent for the public to know what deals are being done.
Finally, let's look at France's Libération. France before the next COVID wave. What does that mean? I mean, are we anticipating a new COVID wave this summer or autumn? I don't think anybody of us could face it.
Well, as you know, looking around you, everyone seems to be having some sort of variant of Omicron now. And in France, they have 70,000 cases, daily new cases at the moment. But as not only in France, which they have a really very beautiful front page with a big wave going over Macron and the Prime Minister, and both of them sitting in the sand and playing and building sandcastles. And the question for them, as for all of us, is should government reintroduce restrictions now and more masks or whatever? Because there are very, very seriously infectious variants of Omicron around. The question is how dangerous are they? Because if it's about having a cold, we might survive this without clogging up the hospitals. But it's a big question how that turns out to be in September when it's getting cooler.
And what is Libération suggesting is the option here? Because governments are clearly racing against time a little bit here, because if there are new variants coming through and they are more than a cold, then we all know what we're looking at.
Well, generally, the French more careful because they have been under severe problems in the first 2 years of COVID. Yeah, so I think the public has a tendency to be more careful about COVID than, for example, here in the UK, where masks now being reintroduced would be impossible.
It would. I wonder if we are actually beyond a lot of restrictions.
Yes, I think so too. But it might become very, very problematic if the boosters won't be distributed quickly enough before it gets colder.
And also it becomes quite political as well, that you find that, the you know, as you say, here in the United Kingdom, for example, asking us to put masks on is impossible because the government's attitude is we have to let it rip. You will get other countries where they will have tested the country's patience, and one wonders how much further they can go.
But generally, I think even in Central Europe, where people were more careful, people are now saying that it will be very difficult to get the public to comply.
Tessa Shishkovitz, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Welcome back. The time here in London is 7:47, just nudging 7:48. Let's talk business now with Isabel Hamilton, senior tech reporter at Business Insider. A very good morning to you, Isabel.
Good morning.
Where would you like to start?
Would you like to start with Truth Social losing one of its sort of founding members?
Go for it. Explain all, please.
So for those listeners who don't know, Truth Social is a social media app that was started by President Donald Trump. It was a sort of reaction to him being kicked off the mainstream social media apps in the wake of the Capitol riots, when he was viewed by the mainstream apps as having incited more violence. And it turns out that, according to a couple of reports, the idea for Truth Social came from a couple of former Apprentice contestants who first pitched the idea to Trump right after the riots. And it turns out, in a Reuters report, that one of the sort of founding pitching members, a man called Andy Dean Latinsky, actually left the company fairly quietly a few months ago. And the Reuters report kind of goes into lots and lots of detail, and it sort of paints a picture of an app that really struggled to come together, partly because they found it really difficult to hire tech talent. They had fairly sort of restrictive policies about who they would hire and looking at their political views, but also lots of tech workers didn't want to come and work for them. And then there were lots of other problems with technical issues because they didn't want to use tools that were built by big tech, things like Amazon cloud servers. So it's interesting that one of these sort of, you know, driving forces behind it has left.
What does this mean for startups that want to start doing something like this? Because yes, there was an awful lot of money behind this. There was an awful lot of power behind this because of Donald Trump. But to look at the fact that it might not actually be getting a toehold against the likes of Twitter and Instagram and what have you. I mean, what's the wider context?
I don't know that this is a particularly typical case that's useful for other startups to hold themselves up to, because, you know, the reasons it found it really hard to find tech talent are largely because of the fact that this is one of Donald Trump's business ventures. There was one someone who was approached by the company who Reuters interviewed, who also said, you know, quite apart from the fact that they found Donald Trump's politics distasteful, he's got quite a long history of business failures, and that was one of the reasons that they decided not to apply for a job. And I think that this isn't a kind of startup that is actually innovative. It's a clone of Twitter, essentially, because Trump lost that platform.
Let's move on to Apple and Google being told to take TikTok away because it's a national security risk. Tell us more there.
So this is an FCC commissioner, a Republican one, called Brendan Carr, who sent a letter to Google and Apple asking them to remove TikTok from their app stores, following on from a BuzzFeed report, because BuzzFeed got their hands on a bunch of recordings from TikTok employees talking about data user data being accessed in China. I don't know how much your listeners know about how TikTok is structured, but essentially TikTok has a parent company called ByteDance in China, and the company has always maintained that the data that US users put into TikTok stays in the US and isn't accessed by anyone outside of the US. These tapes paint a very different picture, with TikTok employees saying that lots of Chinese employees in ByteDance have access to the data, and in fact sometimes saying that they themselves can't access the data and they need someone in China to do it for them.
Isabel Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist, where the time is just coming up to 7.52 here in London. And finally, a new exhibition of work by artists from the African diaspora has opened at London's Hayward Gallery to critical acclaim. It's called In the Black Fantastic, and it features paintings, sculptures and collages inspired by Afrofuturism, a cultural aesthetic that links African diaspora cultures with science fiction. The exhibition and an associated film programme at the BFI looks at the diverse ways black artists are imagining alternate and future realities. Well, Monocle's Lillian Fawcett met the curator of the exhibition in the film programme, Echo Eshin. She asked him what inspired the title In the Black Fantastic.
I think I started thinking about this some time ago, and I was thinking about how black artists, but also black musicians and filmmakers and writers, are increasingly looking towards myth and speculative fictions in their work, and using myth, speculative fiction, collective memories, history, as a way to interrogate the present, as a way to interrogate the racialized present. I'm interested in how artists are exploring the racialized everyday, are exploring the different ways that if you're a black person, you can be subject to violence or microaggression or gaslighting. These artists are creating new spaces that go beyond some of the ways that black people are constrained or held back in the everyday, and about how they're conjuring new spaces of possibility, of dreaming, of fantasy. That's the Black Fantastic.
In the exhibition here, we can see paintings, there's sculpture, there's film. And then alongside it, you also have the series of films at the BFI. Why was it important to represent In the Black Fantastic in many different ways?
This isn't just about visual art. This is also about creative figures from across a range of different disciplines. And so in companion to the exhibition at the Hayward, I've also curated a film program at the BFI, which brings together feature films, also some documentary, also some artists' short films, all of which are still yet further exploring this territory. With the films, I think you see much more clearly with films like Daughters of the Dust, a classic movie by Julie Dash, or even Hollywood feature films like Eve's Bayou, which stars Samuel L. Jackson. With these different films, what you see in those films is the kind of dramas that merge the everyday with the strange and the supernatural, where extraordinary instances and moments seem to just come into focus almost out of nowhere. In film, much more fluently, you see these boundaries being evaporated between the everyday and the supernatural and the magical. Inside this exhibition, we see a different set of propositions. We see artists who are investigating and opening up territory that allows us to think in fantastical terms, sometimes about really difficult moments in history. The work of Kara Walker, for instance, who's showing a new film here. A film here that is about interrogating, I suppose, legacies of white supremacy. But what you see in the exhibition time and again is almost an impossible beauty. Works still, though, that are about this flourishing, are about an insistence of drawing from painful histories, but also drawing from myth and folklore and cultural histories, and using those as an inspiration to create almost new worlds, new utopias, new ways of being and seeing and walking through the world.
This idea of Afrofuturism is also an important theme in the exhibition and in the film programme. What does that mean, and why did you want to explore it?
So Afrofuturism is an idea that was first coined in the 1990s. I suppose that offers a metaphor for Black experience that thinks about the historic ways that Black people were abducted and brought to the West through forced migration, through slavery, how Black people have been made other and alien through the Western imaginary across that whole time. Afrofuturism takes that history and thinks about Black people and our experience in the world through a science fictional lens and says, actually, let's think about how we reimagine Black experience as a realm of fantasy, as a realm of new imagining. Let's, in some cases, imagine Black people as genuinely alien, not just metaphorically alien. So one of the films, for instance, I'm showing as part of the film season is called The Brother from Another Planet, which is about an alien who arrives on Earth who's then hounded and harassed and pursued. He happens to be Black, and the film makes a direct linkage between Blackness, otherness, alienness. It's a kind of classic work, if you want, of Afrofuturist imagining. And that's what Afrofuturism is at its heart. It's a way of understanding, well, it's a way of understanding Black experience.
Brilliant stuff there from Echo Eschen. And In the Black Fantastic is running at BFI South Bank throughout July and at the Hayward Gallery until the 18th of September. Echo's book of the same name is also available now. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. I'm afraid to say thank you to all my guests and to our producers, Rhys James, Charlie Phil McCourt and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researchers were Lillian Fawcett and Isabel Rosen, and our studio manager was Callum McLean. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.